Hi, welcome to the Hungarian Living Podcast. I'm your host, Elizabeth Szabó-Vas. Our goal is to discover, celebrate, and share Hungarian heritage and encourage you to do it too. We'll touch on food, travel, history, music, and language, and share stories from our listeners. We're glad you're here. This is a podcast where we'll encourage you to dig deeper to learn about your Hungarian heritage in a variety of ways. We'll have thought-provoking conversations and share resources. So whether you know a little or a lot about being Hungarian, this is the place to be. Hello, welcome back to the Hungarian Living Podcast. During this series, I'm talking with my friend Andrea Lauer-Rice. She has a unique perspective about 1956 and the Hungarian Revolution, and she has developed and worked on a variety of projects that are gifts to our community as we seek to better understand the events and those we love whose lives changed because of that time. Welcome back to the podcast, Andrea. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Liz. This has been a really wonderful series. I hope your listeners are not too tired of hearing from me, but 1956 is such an incredible topic, and I love talking about how our 56ers have impacted our community in so many different ways.
Well, we're glad to have you back. One of the things you have been involved with for about 5 years is called Memory Project. Can you tell us a little about it and how it got started?
Sure. So in 2015, 5 years ago, for those who can't do the math, which is usually me, my good friend Reka Pignitsky and I started Memory Project, and we called it a visual history archive. And it's basically for the Hungarian American community. It is focused primarily, initially at least, on both DPs, so displaced persons, quote unquote, who came to the U.S. after World War II, and also 56ers. And Reka, for I think many of your listeners will probably know her. If not, please look her up. She has a great website, 56 Films, and she is an award-winning documentary filmmaker. And several of her films actually deal with this question of ethnic identity, of being both Hungarian and American, and what that means. And she and I have been friends for almost 30 years since we both moved to Budapest right after the transition and met there. And what's always interesting to me about Reka is we've been friends for a long, long time, and we work really well together, but we're very, very different. So she grew up in California. You know, I grew up on the East Coast. I'm now in Atlanta. So we often have very different opinions about politics and about baseball teams, no, and everything in between. I don't even think she likes baseball. I think she's more of a soccer girl. But a lot of her movies, as I said, dealt with this idea of kind of growing up in the Hungarian incubator. In fact, one of her movies is called Incubator, and she was born to two parents who were 56ers, and she grew up in Scouts, and she grew up in Hungarian school, and it was just a very different existence. Hungarian was spoken at her home, etc. I grew up, my mom is Hungarian, and left in 56, and my dad was, you know, all American, your typical kind of multiple different ethnicities in his background. But fortunately for all of us, he decided that when he married my mother, he would become an honorary Hungarian. And so that really became a major focal point. But I didn't learn Hungarian fluently until I moved there some 30 years ago. So we had very different upbringings. And I think that is interesting because when we started this project, both of us had a little bit of a track record established in terms of we had done several projects in the 1956 community. And I think that was really key to our early success because we were able to pretty much call up 56ers who either knew about our work or who might have known about Reka's mother's work, Vörös Katalin in San Francisco, or my mother's work, Laura Redit in Cleveland. And if they didn't know about us personally, they knew about our parents, and that would often give us an entree. And that was very important because when we're asking people to share their incredibly personal stories of 1956, you know, you want to make sure that those people that you're sharing these stories with are going to honor them and respect them. And that Absolutely. that was that was incredibly important to us. And so we started this 5 years ago, just prior to the 60th anniversary, knowing that there would be a lot of focus on 1956, and also knowing that time was running out to get these kind of vivid personal testimonials from people. And unfortunately, you know, we've seen that we have 125 interviews in the archive right now. And unfortunately, we, you know, we've already lost a lot of folks who shared their stories with us, who gave us the opportunity when we first started the project.
So both you and Rake have spent time working on individual projects, but then you came together working on this project, and this passion for encouraging people to share their stories with the Hungarian community at large is still very important. It's still a very active project, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, it's evolved a little bit over time, but let me just backtrack a second. What's interesting also when I talk about, you know, Reka and I have so many similarities and we get along so well, but we also have very different approaches to the project. So on the one hand, she's very focused from a documentarian's perspective on recording the histories so that we have them. And she always, you know, kind of laughs at me because she says, oh, you're being so, you know, jingoistic about these things. I, on the other hand, really love the idea of not only passing on the stories to the next generation, but making sure that the spirit of 1956 lives on. It's an incredible time. It was an incredibly important time in Hungarian history. And when we look back at the history of our Hungarian American community, we see what our 1956ers gave to us and continue to give to us in terms of establishing these incredible organizations, in terms of the passion with which they did everything, including pass on their Hungarian identity to the next generation. And of course, you know, I heard about 56 growing up my entire life from my mother, from my grandparents, from my aunt and uncle. Reka also heard about 56, but she was never able to interview her father and really learn his story about 1956. And I know that's something that she very much regrets as a documentary filmmaker. And so, you know, in some ways, we're making sure through this project that nobody else's story is lost. And the great news is that Reka and her sister Esti did join forces for the 50th anniversary and create a wonderful film, really exploring and researching their father's legacy, their father's 56 story. And that's an award-winning film called Journey Home or Hazatérés, which I would highly recommend to everyone. So we are approaching it slightly differently, but I think the importance of recording the stories is the one thing we definitely agree on. At the very beginning of this project, Reka and I started talking about, you know, neither one of us really remember whose idea it was first, but it kind of perfectly came together as a combination of our interests and a combination of the types of projects and events that we had put together in the past, specifically about 1956. And one of the things that we wanted to do, since we were both, you know, I mean, we both had interview experience, we both had experience in journalism. Of course, Reka has this documentary film experience, but the oral history space, the visual history space was, you know, still something we wanted to make sure we knew the best practices that were being used. And so we went to, you know, the very top. We started with the Shoah Foundation. We went to NPR StoryCorps, and we went to the digital storytelling organization in California. And with their help and understanding their methodology, we created the Methodology for Memory Project, which basically is, you know, we use the same set of questions for everybody that we interview. Now that gets changed occasionally because, you know, a good interviewer will listen to the direction in which the story goes, and, you know, we'll put in questions along the way, and certainly we do that. But generally speaking, we keep to the same set of questions, and after, you know, 125 some odd interviews, we've I don't know that we've heard it all, but we've heard a lot. Yeah, sure. We've heard a lot. Yeah.
So a lot of heart and thought has gone into this project, even just on the preparation, you know, beforehand, pulling together the understanding about how to interview questions, but then also during the interview, you might make some adjustments here and there based on the story. Just a lot of investment of time and energy. And now you have created and we have the opportunity to listen to years worth of interviews and stories that are documented on the website. So that's a wonderful gift to the community. How did things go in the early years? You did talk about this just briefly, but was it easy to find people who trusted you with these precious stories? A little bit, it worked with your people knew either a little bit about you and Reika or the parents, but were some people skeptical? How did that work?
I think there's always a healthy degree of skepticism when somebody says, hey, I want to come and videotape you. But the way we organize things is we started within our own communities where we knew people. So we started, I think our first community was actually Cleveland, which is where Reika's sister, Esti, and brother-in-law, Endra, who are very, very active in the community where they live. And that's also where my parents are. And we had, I think it was a list of maybe 6 to 8 interviews when we first started out. And we didn't really have any problem getting people to sign up for the interviews there. We just gave them a phone call and told them what we were trying to do. And they were pretty enthusiastic about sharing their stories. One of the first interviews we did actually, which is pretty interesting, was Joe Esterhaz. And he's typically not very involved in the Hungarian American community. So that was a real coup for us right out of the gates. And he did give a fascinating, fascinating interview. He's not a 56er, but he was a DP, and so we have his story, which is pretty rare. There's not a lot of video interviews with him out there. So yeah, so as you know, I think the second location we traveled to was San Francisco, which is where Reika is from, and also her mom. And so again, we had a pretty good list of folks who knew us well, who knew our work, and who trusted us to tell the story. And I think it also helps that we provide the questions up front. We actually send people a link to the interview. We do very little editing. So unless there's, a big pause or a phone ringing or somebody has a coughing fit or something like that, we really don't edit. We're just pretty much putting it up there in its entirety. And that's because we want people to be able to, to do whatever academic research they want as part of the interview and just want to kind of put it up there so people can see all of it. It would take us quite a bit more time to package it into something, perfect, like a 60 minutes interview. And that's not really what we're about. We're about making sure the story is recorded and it's put up there so, grandkids and kids and communities, right, et cetera, can get access to it. Yeah. So we really didn't find too many people who had issues kind of allowing us to share their story, and the fact that we send the link to them and say, hey, if there's anything you don't want to put in here, or if anything, you have second thoughts about saying something, let us know. And generally speaking, we'll go back and we'll take anything out that they're uncomfortable with.
I'm sure that gives them a sense of security then, knowing that you're willing to make those adjustments. Mm-hmm. So that's great. Now, how has the project changed over the years?
Well, the first couple of years, it was unbelievably time consuming. It was wonderful, an absolute labor of love. But I think at one point, my sweet supportive husband sat me down and he said, "Honey, you've been away 40 days over the past." That had to have been 2 years, right? That couldn't have been 1 year. I'm ashamed to say I don't remember. It might have been 2 years. But essentially, because of course, everyone who runs a nonprofit or a community-based project like this knows funding is, something we always struggle with. So we were always trying to get the best bang for our buck, so to speak. So I would go, Reika would fly from California. I would fly from Atlanta to whatever location we were gathering in. And we would do a tremendous amount of pre-trip work, setting up interviews and doing research on the interview subjects, making sure you know, they knew what to expect, and we had their legal releases ready to be signed, et cetera. We answered any questions, we put them, you know, at ease, et cetera. So there was always a, you know, a measure of that. And sometimes, you know, we also wanted to make sure we were being respectful of the community. We didn't want to just kind of, you know, parachute in and, you know, do our work and then leave without, you know, saying hello to the community leaders, et cetera. So we were trying to be very respectful about the whole thing. So over the years, we determined that, you know, Reka and I still have pretty small kids. Our youngest kids are both in middle school. So it became quite difficult. So we weren't able to match the gung-ho pace of the first couple of years. And so we thought, okay, you know, let's think about maybe an internship program. Let's think about enabling, maybe training folks, you know, young people in different communities and training them to do their own interviews in community. And just training them in the memory project methodology. So we've had a number of different decisions to make on new approaches. Right now, we're back to Reka and I primarily doing the interviews. And Reka has now moved with her family to Hungary. And so she's actually doing quite a bit of work in Hungary and representing memory projects in Hungary. And I'm basically doing the stuff in the United States right now. So it's changed a little bit from that perspective as well. We have shifted it. So it's no longer only the Hungarian American Visual History Archive. It is now technically the Visual History Archive of Hungarian Immigration. So it's a little bit different. And that's mainly because we didn't want to limit ourselves to only the stories about DPs and 56ers. Although there are still a lot, I don't think we're ever going to get to every single one of them. And so we're continuing to try. Sure. But we discovered that there were so many wonderful stories along the way. And we wanted to make sure that we had an opportunity to record those as well. For example, we did an interview last year with Governor George Pataki from New York. Fascinating interview.
Oh, I bet.
Governor Pataki, you know, grew up on his grandparents' very Hungarian farm in Peekskill, New York. And it really influenced him and had a powerful impact on him and how he grew up and his beliefs. And we just thought that was such a great story. We didn't want to pass that up. I'm actually right now talking to the Lantos family, the family of former Congressman Tom Lantos, who has now sadly passed away. But what an incredible story the Lantos family has. They're Jewish and Hungarian and Mormon. And they made it a top priority to raise their kids Hungarian, to be proud of their Hungarian heritage. So that's another, you know, incredible story that is not out there right now. And we want to make sure that we have an opportunity to record those stories and share it with the community. So the other thing I'll say about our project is not only is it the story of people leaving Hungary and coming to the United States, but we do try to, it's almost like a life story or a life history. So we start with, you know, childhood, learning a little bit about everyone's family, learning about the situation in Hungary just prior to the decision to escape or to flee. And then we talk about that, you know, very emotional part of leaving, making the decision to leave, actually setting foot across the border. And then, you know, what the ideas were, what the expectations were for life in the United States. What did they know about the United States? What did they actually encounter in the United States? Were the streets really paved with gold? And then how did they find a way? Was it important for them? And how did they find a way to continue to celebrate and hold on to their Hungarian heritage? So it's a little bit of all of these themes interspersed, which I think makes it a very valuable resource. I'm incredibly proud of the past 5 years of work we've put into this. And I'm looking forward to this continuing on for a long, long time, because I don't think we'll ever run out of stories. So the very fact that we've renamed the project now to the Visual History Archive of Hungarian Immigration, that, you know, we did that because a couple of years ago, Reka did some interviews with 56ers who emigrated to Germany. And now that she's back in Budapest, she's just discovered a new story that she absolutely loves, which are you know, Hungarians who left in 56 and went to South America. And now they're coming back into Hungary. And isn't that a fascinating new twist? So, you know, we do love some of the side topics and some of the side stories that we discover during Memory Project. In fact, in the middle of the project, we actually started to hear a story that neither of us had ever heard before, which was frankly shocking. 60 years after 1956, and with the amount of work and research we've done and discussions we've had with 56ers through the years, I mean, you know, when we first heard the story, Rekha and I kind of looked at each other and thought, oh my gosh, you know, have you ever heard this story? No, have you? Oh my God, we got to look into this. So that was actually a documentary project, completely new, that sprang from Memory Project. It was called Le Vesak, or Cold Warriors. So it's basically the story of a farm in Rummerfield, Pennsylvania, where a very passionate Hungarian gentleman who emigrated to the United States wanted to make sure that he had a young group of people. It was scout-like in terms of the camp, but it was a very, very passionate crew. And he, in addition to all the regular scouting activities, he actually trained them in military tactics. And the initial premise of this organization was that if anything like 1956 ever happened again, this crew would be ready to go back to Hungary and fight.
And what were the ages?
Yeah, I mean, they were young. They were young teens, most of them, and many of them had never even been to Hungary. So, I mean, the concept of before you join this crew, you have to sign a contract
and commit,
and go back to potentially give up your life. I mean, it was pretty amazing. So when we started hearing about this story, we knew there was just an incredible larger picture that we had to paint. And sure. And so believe it or not, you know, we determined that I had this connection that was very close to where I went to college at Lehigh University. And I actually had a connection to the gentleman who owned the farm now. And we reached out to the folks who were involved in this military scout troop, and we brought them all back together for an incredible, memorable weekend at the farm. And it became, you know, this great story, not just of what this gentleman, Vasvári Zoltán, had created, but also the impact that it had on these young kids, and how they, you know, they didn't really think back on it and think, oh yeah, military training, I was ready to go. It was more just a different way to pass on heritage to this group. And we find great stories like that all the time. So,
and that is on the site, that's on the website or the.
That is, yeah, that's on the memoryproject.online website. And it's in both English and Hungarian. It's been played on Hungarian television. And you'll also find, as we all prepare for this year, the 64th anniversary of 1956, and of course, next year will be the next big anniversary, the 65th anniversary, you'll also find a number of compilations that we've created, trailers that anybody can download and they can play at their different events, commemorative events, celebratory events. But also, you know, you can scroll through. I have people who tell me all the time, oh, I just, you know, happened upon your website and I found three or four people I knew and I spent, you know, a wonderful afternoon listening to some of these interviews. And some of them are just amazing.
So listening to these memories and recording them must be, I mean, first of all, it's fascinating, but there have to be some very moving stories that you and Rekha get to hear. And I would imagine that each of those interviews just strengthens your resolve to continue the project, encourages other people to also not wait for you to come to them to do a memory project, but that somebody can do their own memory project. And you have resources at the website. We've mentioned them before, but in another episode of the podcast, but mention again where they can see the interview questions.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great point, Liz. And that's one of the things that kind of breaks our heart when people reach out to us and say, please, you know, please come and help record my father's story. You know, he doesn't have much time left. And we just, you know, we can't do a one-off interview. We have to, you know, generally kind of find a cluster of 6 to 8 interviews. And of course, now that Reka's in Hungary, it's a little more difficult. So yeah, right. Please don't wait for us. We would love, you know, to be the ones to go and capture all the stories, but logistically, obviously now in the days of COVID, it's not going to work. So please go to freedomfighter56.com. That's an oral history website that we did for the 50th anniversary that does have a list of questions on in terms of memory project. When we first started the project, as I mentioned earlier, we went to StoryCorps, NPR StoryCorps. StoryCorps actually has a fantastic free phone app out. So I would recommend you download the phone app and you can actually go through and pick your own questions or fashion questions off of the interview guide. And then that gives you, I think, 45 minutes total to do an interview, which is a little bit short. You could also go just on your voice memo on your phone if you don't have a video camera. But I would definitely recommend that in some way you make sure that your story or your relative story or your community member story is recorded in some way, shape, or form. And now that I've mentioned, you know, during the days of COVID, we have done a couple interviews on Zoom. It is certainly not our favorite way to do an interview, but it is a possibility. And we're exploring actually, you know, different technologies to try to get a little more consistent quality connection. But it is, you know, that is an alternative, since we're not exactly sure how long our lockdown is going to happen or our limited right. travel is going to happen. Again, it certainly doesn't even come close to, you know, going into somebody's home, spending a half day with somebody and really learning about their story, getting to know their family, seeing their pictures. But that's one of our favorite parts. And, you know, oftentimes after spending that time with somebody and hearing their story, you know, people will come out and say, oh, let me show you, you know, this. Like one of the first interviews we did in Cleveland was Orsak Tibor, who's a wonderful, wonderful character. And after we did the interview, he said, oh, hold on a second. And he went downstairs and he brought up a photo album of pictures that he had taken, or I think actually not technically he, but a friend of his had taken and he had in his possession. And they had, as far as I know, never before been displayed or, wow. Or seen by any large number of people. I think it was Chicheri Zsigaba who said, oh, you know, come with me. And he showed us right next to the, on a back wall in the house. I think it was next to his bedroom. He had a framed version of the 16 points that, oh, wow. That the students had created and he had actually brought out with him during the revolution. We had, let me think, Földváry Tibor from Boston who showed us his diary. I mean, there's just some incredible
lots of treasures.
Things. Yeah, incredible things out there. A lot of people still have the Camp Kilmer bag that they got when they arrived at Camp Kilmer, and it had some of the, you know, some of the necessities that they might need. I've seen more than one person still has the letter of welcome to the United States.
Oh wow!
Yeah, so there's some pretty incredible things out there, not just the memories, of course, but also, I guess, artifacts and ephemera related mm-hmm. to 1956 that, you know, we're trying to figure out what the best way is to store those, to protect those, to house those here in the United States. So we're in conversations about that as well.
Okay. So do you have a clip that you could share with us so that our listeners can get a sense of what kinds of things to expect when they go to the website?
Absolutely. As I said, there's a number of compilations on the website itself, but I kind of mined through a couple of these to just give you an idea of some of the stories, little snippets of the stories that you can hear. Okay. So I'm going to stop talking now and let our brave 56ers tell the story in their own words.
this whole feeling or experience of almost a combustion of desire for freedom, that one day you weren't supposed to do anything, and my parents were constantly warning us not to do anything, and the next day there were hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating on the street. That was unheard of, and of course one had to have the feeling, what's going to be the consequence?
What happened was, the people from the farms, from the villages, they knew that the city was starving, because now it's been several days and there was no food supply going on a regular basis to the city. So these guys voluntarily loaded up trucks, like oversized pickup trucks. So I ran down on the street, and I don't know what I got, maybe a cabbage, couple of potatoes, I don't know. I was so happy, you know? And they said, yeah, God bless you. That was it. So they didn't want no money.
So we actually arrived in Austria on the 1st of December, 1956. That's when I looked back from the border and I saw my Hungary behind me. So you never wanted to leave?
I studied English, but I needed practice. But I got a job, so for 8 hours a day, I had to speak English. And I asked my colleagues, correct me. I don't want to make mistakes. Don't feel, oh, how cute accent, blah, blah, blah. But just correct me.
As a historian, I very much believe in history being preserved, not just on paper and in writing, but visually and through the media. And so I think this is as important as writing a book. Look, I'm 72 years old. And once I'm gone, this oral history will be gone.
But the key point at that meeting was quite late, must have been easily 8, 9 o'clock, that a stuttering guy, whose name was Balint András, and he was in the same dorm as where I lived on Bartók Béla út, he put up his hand and he asked a question, stuttering, why are still Soviet troops stationed in Hungary? Everybody looked at his or her neighbor, what will they react to it? And all of a sudden, in an uncontrolled way, 2,000 people began to chant, Ruski Khaza, Russians go home. And that was, I think, psychologically the moment from which there was no return.
I heard this popping sound, and I thought, geez, there must be guns, and I dropped on the ground immediately. And a few minutes later, I felt this body fall on top of me, and I had this warm liquid flowing over my face and on my hands. And I turned and happened to be one of my friends who was shot in the head. And I thought to myself, what the hell are you bastards doing?
Wow. A lot of moving stories. I could tell that there's time to be spent at this website, just listening to the stories and actually feeling like I could understand a bit better about what took place, even though it happened before my time. But by having this documentation, it helps me get a better sense of it.
Let me just mention one other quick thing. So we have some very historic figures who were on the site. We have Paul Molitor Jr. We have Imre Tóth, who actually worked in the parliament during this time. We have Andy Vajna, who, of course, is of Hollywood fame and just recently passed away. I mentioned Joe Esterházy, George Pataki. So there's a number of pretty well-known people on the site. And their stories are very, very interesting. But to me, you know, you really get a sense of 1956 and the spirit behind it and the impact of it when you listen to the everyday stories, when you listen to Juliana Csungor, whose husband's best friend was killed during 1956, and she talks about how they named their firstborn son after him. Or Tibor Orszag, whose One of my favorite characters, who I first met on the 50th anniversary of 1956 in Budapest. And he had his kids had all surprised him, and they all went to Budapest together. And his gift was this jacket with a huge Hungarian crest on the back. And said, "Remember Hungary, 1956. I mean, he lived and breathed 1956. And he talks all about, I think we actually read it in one of the prior segments, what is a freedom fighter? And it's not just, it wasn't just the folks who took up the arms. It was many, many other people who helped in the effort in some way. And that I think is the story of 1956, right? That it was started by the students, but it swept across the entire nation. And to hear the impact, it's just really incredible, especially in their own words. And that's really why we did it. That's why we continue to do these interviews. And one of the most special interviews to me, I'm very proud to say that my aunt Nora Sabol is part of the archive. An interview I did with my grandmother back in 2000, with my husband. She's also in the archive, and my mother, Edith Lauer, is in the archive. And while we interviewed my mom, my youngest child was sitting underneath the chair and listened to his Najmami tell her story. And we also have some great photographs that my uncle took. He's unfortunately passed away before we could get his story, but we have his photographs as well. So I'm very proud that a lot of my family history is there, and we're trying to make sure that everybody can say the same thing, that that we can reach out to these wonderful folks and make sure that they know that their parents' story lives on, because it's an incredibly important part of our history and something that I think we all still, we all still can connect to. I mean, the Hungarian freedom fighter, whenever I have a bad day, come on now, you've got the blood of a freedom fighter in you. Let's go,
That's right. Well, thank you for sharing with us a little deeper about the resources that you've developed. And I know that we're going to be checking out the website and getting connected with the stories and, considering our own stories a little more deeply, because we all have something to share and we've all been impacted in one way or another with our Hungarian heritage, whether or not it was a 56 story or not, but there's been impact in our lives. That's why we pay attention to Hungarian things, or we're involved to the degree that we're involved in. So thank you, Andrea, again for being here. And thanks for listening to this episode of the Hungarian Living Podcast. We will include links in the show notes, so be sure to visit HungarianLiving.com and be sure to check out the websites, so that you can see what is happening at Memory Project. And we'll catch you next time. Hungarian Living is a division of Magyar Marketing, the Hungarian store, where you can find meaningful gifts with Hungarian style. Check us out at magyarmarketing.com. And special thanks to Stephen Chichek and the Animal Cannibals for the show music. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of Hungarian Living, please subscribe and share this podcast with your favorite Hungarian. Check out our show notes for links to resources mentioned in this episode. If you have a question or comment, email us at podcast@hungarianliving.com. We'll catch you next time.